Okay, so yes, well, some of you may remember that we're starting a new theme. So some of you may also remember that we do year-long themes. They just seem to sort of drift on and on and on and on. They are actually very carefully planned and thought out. And the structure of the thoughts is also thought out. And every September we change it round again so that we can start a new course around September. And we like to do lists. We like to go deeply into lists. That's what Buddhists do. They go deeply into lists. And last year we looked at the 10 perfections. And this week we've shortened the list. We're going to look at the 3 jewels. So it's very easy to remember, apart from anything else. So you will have learned something, even by the end of this evening, which is a list of 3. And we chose this because, well, partly because it gives us lots of scope to look at things in more detail, but also because the symbolism of the 3 jewels is so centrally important to Buddhism, and particularly to our order. So, yes, in 1967, Sangharakshita set up the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. And in 1968, he set up the Western Buddhist Order. It's a funny way round. They were Friends of the Western Buddhist Order before the Western Buddhist Order even existed. But a year later, it was followed by the Western Buddhist Order. And at that time, when Sangharakshita set it up, it was a small movement centered around a basement in central London. So a small group of people. He had big visions, but at that moment, it was a small group of people in a basement in central London. And in a way, what Sangharakshita wanted to do was he realized that a new Buddhist movement was necessary. He realized that we couldn't continue importing culturally wholesale Buddhism from the East. We couldn't continue just having Sri Lankan Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism or Japanese Buddhism. We had to, a new Buddhist movement was needed that wasn't based on a particular Eastern culture, but was Buddhism expressed in a new way suitable for the Western world. And this was a very radical idea. You know, it takes a lot of guts to say, actually, we need a new Buddhist movement. He was ordained as a monk in the East. He had traditional Eastern Buddhist teachers. And he thought, well, actually, that's not going to work. It's not going to work in the modern Western world. We need something new. You know, and even today, I happen to be having tea with my cousin, who's the Dean of Norwich Cathedral. That's my name dropping for this evening. And I was telling him about our movement, and he was sort of saying, what, you mean your teacher set up a new Buddhist school? And I said, yes. And he goes, well, you can't just set up a new Buddhist school. Oh, I thought, well, you know, St. Benedict did, St. Francis did, why can't Sangharakshita? But, you know, it was a really radical thing to do. And people even got quite upset sometimes and quite angry. But, you know, that's what Sangharakshita realised that needed to happen. That's what needed to happen. And that's what we're benefiting from. We're benefiting from those early years in the central London basement. But, of course, what happened, as we know, is the movement grew. The Western Buddhist Order grew. The Friends of the Western Buddhist Order grew. And went to different cultures. It became, for example, particularly popular in India, where, of course, they couldn't call it the Western Buddhist Order, so they called it the Trilokya Bauddha Mahasangha. And, of course, it went to other cultures. It went to New Zealand and Finland, South America, Poland, Russia, Hungary, South Africa, all these different cultures where, as we know, the name Western either isn't appropriate or is actually very unpopular at the moment. You know, it's not cool to be a Westerner now. And Sangharakshita realised that it's not that we're trying to find a new way of expressing Buddhism in the Western world, but that we're trying to find a new way of expressing Buddhism in the modern globalised culture. And that applies worldwide. So what he decided was that we needed a new name that underlined what unites us all. What unites all these different Buddhist groups from, with Sangharakshita as their teacher, in all these different cultures. What do we all have in common? Well, it's not that we're all Western, clearly. It's not that we share a culture. It's not that we share a particular lifestyle, as we know, many different order members live different lifestyles. It's not that we necessarily all study the same Buddhist text. You know, people in this movement, they have a wide understanding of lots and lots of different Buddhist texts. It's not that we all do the same single meditation practice. You know, we haven't based the movement on the mindfulness of breathing or the Metta Bhavana. It's not the Metta Bhavana movement, which is sort of a shame from my point of view, but then again. It's not that we've all shared the same mantra. It's not that our movement's based on the fact that we all, I don't know, do the Padmasambhava mantra or something. Actually, what unites us all is our commitment to Buddhism, and particularly in more traditional language, what unites us all is our going for refuge to the three jewels, the Buddha, the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma, and the Buddhist community, which is the Sangha. That's what unites us all. We might live, we might be from different cultures, we might have different lifestyles, we might have different texts that we study or draw inspiration from. It might be that we're doing different meditations at any one time. It might be that we're all taking up a different mantra. But what unites us all is our commitment to the three jewels, to the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. So Sangha actually changed the name of the order this year, much to everyone's surprise. And we all did just get an email saying, by the way, you thought you were ordained into the Western Buddhist Order, but it's changed now. Which I think is brilliant, and I was very happy to get that email. And it says, well, we're now, he suggested that we're now called the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. And Tri Ratna means three jewels in Sanskrit. So, in a way, what he was doing was drawing attention to the fact this is what unites us. It's not a culture. What unites us is our common commitment to the Buddha, the kind of deep values at the heart of Buddhism. So it's very, very important to our order, this symbolism of the three jewels. But it's also very, very important to the whole Buddhist world. And we're going to spend a year exploring what these three jewels are, what they mean. So tonight, I can't do the whole thing, a year's course in one evening. This is not the quick route. It's just going to be an introduction. So I'm going to talk a bit about the symbolism of the jewel, what going for refuge means, and what the jewels are, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So first of all, they're called the three jewels. It's one of those things you can overlook if you've been a Buddhist for quite a while. You know, it's just like, we just trot out this language. Well, I'm a Buddhist because I go for refuge to the three jewels. But actually, it's quite important symbolism. And it's worth reflecting what it actually means. So the symbol of the jewel is reoccurs a lot in Buddhism. We have the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum, which means the jewel is in the lotus. We've got the Chintamani, or the wish-fulfilling jewel. Ratnasambhava, the jewel-born Buddha. We've got the Vajra, or the diamond thunderbolt of reality. And at the heart of Buddhism is the symbol of the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I've just remembered, that's what those little blobs are on the kesa. So Sangharaj's point is, well, it's interesting that we call them the three jewels, because they could have been called the three refuges, they could have been called three fundamental principles, or the three essentials. But actually, it's always traditional to call them the three jewels. And what do the three jewels mean? And in a way, he says, well, it's because the Buddhist tradition wanted to draw attention to the inherent value of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. They're not just ideas. They're not even just principles or essentials. They're actually something that's of deep value. So the jewel is found deep in the earth. Now, so I really enjoyed actually thinking about what a jewel actually is. So if you think about it, if you bring to mind a jewel and where they come from, well, they come from deep in the earth. And it's a bit like, when I thought about this, I thought of kind of, well, you've got worldly life and human activity on the surface, you know. So there we are, you know, buying, selling, going to work, coming home, having a bath, whatever it is. Kind of rushing around on the surface, and yet underneath the earth is deep and still and quiet. I don't know if any of you have been to any of the caves in Castleton. And sometimes they do this thing where they turn the light off and you're right down inside. And it's really spooky because it could be any time of the day and anything could be happening above and you're in this kind of deep stillness, this deep silence. And that's where the jewels are found, in that deep silence. Beyond all kind of petty day-to-day concerns, even beyond the human. You get this feeling in a cave like that when the lights are switched off and you think, I'm not absolutely sure that I'm top of the food chain here. I'm not absolutely sure that I'm in control. You know, usually we're kind of in control. But if we go deep into the earth or deep into the sea, deep into the oceans, we're not the ones who are in control. There's something, there's some much deeper force alive there. Mind you, that is just my imagination. I don't think anyone's got eaten in Castleton Caves, but you never know. And it's this kind of timeless realm underneath the earth. And this is the thing about jewels, they're old, they're ancient. They're formed by the enormous pressure that's created by seismic shifts in the Earth's crusts. So Earth's crust. So it's like, you know, there they are, there's something happens. Conditions take place. Conditions mean that tremendous pressure is created. And out of that tremendous pressure, something different is made. When conditions are right, a jewel is born. And the jewel is sort of, it's different. It's different from mud. It's created out of the mud and the rock and the earth crust and whatever chemical processes that happen. But in a way, what's produced is something very different. Something even of a different order. And it's beautiful and fascinating. There's something very, very fascinating about jewels that just kind of draw you in. And then, of course, when they're extracted out of the earth, they're polished, they're made into precious jewellery, and they're everlasting. I'm actually wearing my family jewels tonight. I thought it would be a real shame if I got robbed on my way here. But anyway, I'm wearing my family jewels, and there is something about when you pass them from generation to generation, they're not easily broken. There's something that's a kind of timeless value and very, very beautiful. And that's what the three jewels represent. They represent that kind of value. They represent something that's formed under great pressure. Something's beautiful that's created under certain conditions. And the thing about jewels is that when you find them, you have to kind of use them. You have to adorn them. You have to love them. That's the thing about treasure. In a way, it's like there's no point in just having treasure and then just locking it in a room. Or like my mum's friend, hiding all your family jewels in the freezer. Because if you just hide them in the freezer, actually she also, that same woman, hid them in the coal scuttle once as well. So if you just hide them in the coal scuttle or the freezer, in a way you're not making use of them. All they are then are just bits of glass and bits of metal. To really make use of treasure, you've got to bring it out, you've got to polish it, adorn it, love it. Show it to people. So a few years ago I was on a seminar with Sangharakshita and we were talking about reflection and he said, well, in a way you don't need to make it that conscious. The best things to reflect on are the phrases of the Dharma or verses of the Dharma that just, you don't even need to learn them. They're just the ones that just stick in your mind and go round and round your mind all the time. Those verses of the Dharma you just seem to have a preoccupation with. And I was thinking about that and I was thinking, God, well, what verses have really stuck in my mind about the Dharma? And I was thinking, you know, actually I quite wanted it to be something really mystical and really mysterious and kind of subtle and wise. And actually what happened was the only bit of the Dharma that's really immediately stuck in my mind wholesale without me having to learn it is a phrase from Sangharakshita's teacher, Jagdish Kashyap. And he was talking about a certain set of monks. And what he said is, they are a set of monkeys sitting on a treasure, the value of which they do not understand. Which I was really disappointed at, actually. I wanted something much more, you know, perfection of wisdom or something. But anyway, that's what stuck in my mind. They are a set of monkeys sitting on a treasure, the value of which they do not understand. And the reason it stuck in my mind was because I had this horrifying image. And the horrifying image was me as a monkey sitting on top of a treasure, or even sometimes dancing on top of a treasure, the value of which I do not understand. And I thought, what a waste of a life. You know, what a waste of your life, Adutari. You're sitting on this treasure. You've got the three jewels, the most valuable thing in existence, and you're sitting on top of it, and you don't even know what you've got. So there you go. And in order to really understand the treasure that we've got in the three jewels, we have to go back to the Buddhist vision. And the Buddhist vision is that sort of cosmic world view is that there's always worlds coming in and out of existence. All the time, universes upon universes coming in and out of existence. And when conditions are ripe, a Buddha will arise. And with the Buddha comes the Dharma. And with the Dharma comes the Sangha. It's just the same as under certain conditions, jewels are made. But the point is, in Buddhist cosmology, is that sometimes those conditions aren't there. And you have what's called an empty kalpa, or an empty aeon, where there's a world system where no Buddha arises. The conditions aren't ripe, the Buddha doesn't arise. It's empty. And what that brings home to people is the fact that we live in a time when a Buddha has arisen and we're benefiting from his teachings, even 2,500 years later. We live at a time when the three jewels are present, and we live in a place and time where we can actually practice the Buddha's teaching, where we can gain inspiration from the Buddha, and when we can do that together with the Sangha. And it's worth remembering that actually we only set up activities in Sheffield in 1988. So before 1988, you wouldn't really have been able to practice Buddhism in Sheffield. I don't know when other Buddhist groups came, but I think we were probably the first. So you wouldn't have been able to practice Buddhism, at least not with this movement, until 1988. And this is the point that Padmasambhava, the great Indian teacher who established Buddhism in Tibet, this is his point. He says, now we have been born in a civilized land where the Buddha Dharma is present. We have obtained what is difficult to attain, a precious human body. And while our sense faculties are still intact, we can meet with sublime masters, have the power to choose whatever we want to do, can enter the Buddha's teachings, practice the sacred Dharma, and associate with Sangha companions. If at this time we don't apply the teachings that bring liberation and enlightenment, this precious human body will have gone to waste. Don't return empty-handed after reaching the island of jewels. Don't linger around hungry when having met the inexhaustible treasure. So his point was that we've reached an island of jewels. We've reached the inexhaustible treasure. And it's not enough to just reach that island and just sit there like a monkey on top of the treasure. You actually have to use it. You have to use it. You have to value it. You have to adorn it and love it and polish it and hold it up to the light and share it with others. So really to really value and make use of the three jewels, it's not enough to have them present around us. We have to, in traditional language, go for refuge to them. We have to apply them in our lives. And this is the meaning of going for refuge. I said a few weeks ago, but I'll say it again because it's quite important in the early Buddhist tradition. There's this kind of stock phrase that happens every time someone sees the value of the Buddha's teaching. So someone is taught the Dharma and they reflect on the Dharma and they understand the Dharma and something catches them in their heart. And they say, magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama, that's the Buddha. Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyes to see. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dharma for refuge, and to the Sangha for refuge. From today, let Master Gotama remember me as a follower who has gone for him for refuge for life. So what happens in these early texts is you know, you've got to kind of look behind the stock phrases and see that that was a genuine spiritual experience. That they'd seen what was of value in the three jewels, and they chose to commit themselves to what was of value to them in their lives. So they see the three jewels not only as valuable, but something that they can move towards. So the language of going for refuge is interesting, because it's not I take refuge, it's not I accept the refuges. You go for refuge, you move towards those refuges. It's an active term, it's not a passive term. And then there's this whole idea of a refuge itself. And sometimes this language is quite, you know, you have to really reflect on why they use the word, the term refuge. So, actually I looked up refuge in the dictionary, and it says, a place of safety and shelter. And then it says, British traffic island. So in the British term, I take as my traffic island, I go towards the traffic island of the Buddha, the Dharma and Sangha. That kind of is not bad an image really. In a way what you're doing is you're taking the three jewels as a place of safety and of shelter amidst the chaos and the suffering and the danger of everyday life. In a way, a kind of busy road isn't a bad analogy. It's like samsara, you know. You're kind of trying to navigate in samsara, and there's all these things hurtling towards you, and bonkers drivers, and, you know, lights, and chaos, and great danger, and sometimes you can get incredibly complacent and then just drift off the road or something. So that's what we do. We go to the three jewels for refuge amidst the sufferings of samsara. It's very famous verses from the Dhammapada that say, many people out of fear flee for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees and shrines. In reality, this is not a safe refuge. In reality, this is not the best refuge. Fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from all suffering. He who goes for refuge to the Buddha, to the Dharma and to the Sangha, for him this is a safe refuge, for him this is the best refuge. Having gone to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So what you do as a Buddhist, what unites all Buddhists, is that you make the three jewels your true refuge, the guiding force in your life. You see them as what's of true value and you place your heart upon them. You rely on them. You look to them for an answer to the problems of suffering and the problems of samsara. And as when you become ordained in the Triratna Buddhist order, in a way what you're saying is that you're going to put those three jewels in the centre of your life and arrange your life around those jewels. You're going to arrange your life around what is of greatest beauty and greatest value to you in your life. And there might be other beautiful and valuable things in your life. It's not saying that they're the only beautiful and valuable things. But actually, you can only put some things, or you can only even put one thing in the centre of your life. You can only choose a few things to really place your heart on. And what you're saying when you're an order member is, these are the things that I really trust. These are what are of true value to me, more than anything else. It's not that other things don't matter, but this is the central thing. This is the guiding principle. This is what's really, really important to me. So I'm going to look at the three jewels just in turn to sort of maybe give a few hints of why they're valuable and why they're refuges. But really, a lot of these are my own personal reflections. So it's something that everyone needs to do themselves. Particularly if you're a Buddhist and you, as we all do, myself included, we trot out this phrase, You know, well, I'm a Buddhist because I go for refuge to the three jewels. You know, you don't even actually put little spaces between the letters. I'm a Buddhist because I go for refuge to the three jewels. So, you know, in a way, if we're saying we are Buddhist because we go for refuge to the three jewels, we need to really, really think what they are. And don't just give a stock answer that the tradition has given you. You have to really, really reflect. Do you know what's of value? And do you know why it's of value? So let's start with the Buddha. The Buddha, the enlightened one, who was born a human being about 2,500 years ago in northern India. And by his own effort, he became enlightened and thereby rediscovered the ancient pathway to enlightenment. That's his analogy. He says he rediscovered an ancient pathway. And this ancient pathway he made clear to other people. So that's the Buddha. But why is he a value? Why is he valuable? Why is he a jewel? Why is he a refuge? I kind of like this. There's one part where, in actually, what in some traditions said to be the first discourse of the Buddha, and the way he put it is slightly my own elaboration. But anyway, the way he kind of generally put it was. It was a bit like when the eye of the Buddha opened. So he was underneath the Bodhi tree and he became enlightened. He saw the way things are. The eye of the Buddha opened. And when he saw the way things are, he saw that the cessation of suffering was possible. It was possible to be free from suffering. And you were free from suffering with the stilling or the quenching of the fires of greed, hatred, and ignorance. So he saw that it was possible to be free from suffering. Now that is quite a profound thing, because I don't want to suffer, and I don't want anyone else to suffer. And the Buddha didn't want to suffer, and he didn't want anyone else to suffer. And it was a real problem in his life, a real question that he searched long and hard for the answer for. You know, he says again and again, it's not only suffering, but the answer to violence and hatred and the chaos of samsara, the agitation of samsara. And this was a deep question to him. And what he realized on enlightenment was that it was possible to be absolutely free from suffering. Not because you rearranged the world to suit yourself, but because you saw into the way things are and you conquered your own greed and hatred and ignorance. And that was possible, and not only was it possible, he did it. And that's the other thing that he said in his first sermon. He says, I saw it was possible, and I did it. I verified it myself. I saw it for myself. And the fact that the Buddha was able to do that, was able to verify that it is possible to be free from suffering in his own experience, means that we can also do it. It means that we too can be free from suffering ourselves. And it's the example of the Buddha that shows what it's like to be free from suffering. To show in a kind of living example what someone looks like when they're free of greed, hatred, and delusion. Or to put it in more positive terms, what it looks like when someone has boundless love and compassion, boundless wisdom, boundless energy. And he's a real example of what that would actually look like. So we need to go back to the original texts, all the texts of Buddhism, and read it with imagination to think, this is what it's like. This is what it's like to be a Buddha. This is what it looks like when you're free from suffering, when you've developed that boundless love and compassion and wisdom and energy. And if you can, you know, you have to go and kind of get past, well, not only ancient Indian language, but you've also got to get past the English translations of that language. And sometimes it's a bit formulaic. You know, it was an oral tradition for many, many years. And sometimes it's a bit formulaic. Sometimes it's a little clipped and terse. So you've got to read it with imagination. You've got to picture the Buddha in mind and get a sense of who he is as a living presence. Sangharakshita describes his personality as a unique combination of dignity and affability, wisdom and kindliness. And in a way, you really get a sense of that if you just look, go back to the original teachings. And it's important that we do that. It's important that we get a sense of the Buddha's living presence, because he gives us a picture much more than even a glimpse of an Indian sage living 2,500 years ago. He's giving us a glimpse of who we could be. He's giving us a glimpse of our potential. And this is very important to me because all through my life, I've grown up with a sense of my own human destiny. And it's a bit like I've always had this thought, here's my existence, and what do I do with it? Sangharakshita, he's a very, very well-educated man, and he quotes someone called G. Lois Dickinson, who I've never heard of, but anyway, he's got a good quote. He says, man is in the making, but henceforth he must make himself. To that point, nature has led him out of the primeval slime. Let him look no more to her for aid, for it is her will to create one who has the power to create himself. His fate is in his own hands. And I think that's the sense that we can sometimes get very vividly, or at least I can get very vividly. It's left up to me to have the power to create myself. And my fate is in my own hands. And that's a tremendous it's a tremendous responsibility. And sometimes it's felt to me like a burden. It's felt to me like a very, very heavy burden, one that I would absolutely love to get rid of. What do I do with my life? What do I create out of my life? Indeed, what is the ideal existence that is possible for someone to create out of their life? And the Buddha and the people who came to see the Buddha obviously had the same question. And if you read the early texts, you see that the question comes up again and again and again. And the Buddha took great pains to explain what is the ideal human existence. What is the Brahmin, or the great man? Who is the true wanderer? Who are the wise? Who's the true sage? There's a story of someone coming to see the Buddha and says, who in the world is happy? Is there anyone who isn't full of agitation? Who deserves the title super being? I don't know what that is in Pali. So, who deserves the title super being? What are they like? How do you become the ideal existence, ideal person? How do you fashion your existence into something truly worthwhile? And the Buddha says, well, you know, the ideal person is not someone who's just born in the right family. It's someone who makes something out of their existence and makes something truly wonderful out of their existence, like a jewel created out of tremendous pressure. And he offered his own life and the life of his disciples as examples of the ideal person. He called them the ocean crosser, a traveller beyond the deserts and the doubts, a voyager who has reached the other shore, who has become free from the smoke fumes, the trembling and hunger of desire and craving. And he described in great detail what an ideal person would look like. And that person is an enlightened person. There's this lovely story which I was relating to Kirsty this afternoon, which is quite simple, but it's quite profound, I think, where the Buddha's just sitting there, and he's sitting there with a group of monks. And in the distance, he sees coming towards him his disciples, a group of his great disciples. And he sits there and he says, he turns around to his monks and he says, those are Brahmins who are coming, monks. Those are Brahmins who are coming. And he wasn't talking about a particular Indian caste that was born in a particular way. He was talking about, those are great men. He was trying to redefine the word Brahmin to mean someone who'd created the best they could out of their existence. They'd fashioned the great man, the great person out of their existence. And he'd seen them. And he was delighting in the fact that they'd done it. They'd reached the pinnacle of human existence. And the Buddha offered a method. He just didn't just leave it as a description of who was the great man, who was the ideal person, what was possible for human existence. He offered a method to achieve that vision. He offered the vision, and he offered a method to create that vision. in the ideal existence. And this is the Dharma. So there's a lovely story again with a wanderer called Dotoka. And Dotoka is obviously just in raptures. He's just so excited to be with the Buddha. Actually, I think that's my projection, but anyway. He's really, really happy. He's really delighted. And he's longing for the teachings of the Buddha. And he says, I can see now that there is in this world a man who has nothing, a Brahmin, a wanderer. I bow down and honour you, sir, the eye that sees everything. Please, man of the Shakya clan, free me from confusion. And the Buddha replies, it is not in my practice to free anyone from confusion. When you have understood the most valuable teachings, then you yourself will cross this ocean. And it's very profound, because sometimes what can happen with the burden of human existence is we can just want to kind of chuck it at someone and say, you know, you do it. You deal with my human existence. You do something for me. I'll give my will over to you. You just take it and run. You know. Or you want to hide from it. You want to pretend that it isn't a burden and you're just going to get on. You just distract yourself from existence. But what the Buddha did is he put the responsibility of his disciples back on the disciples themselves. He says, you have to take my teachings and you have to put them into practice in your own life. You have to understand them for yourselves. And in a way, he makes it very easy for us. So the Dharma has two sort of shades of meaning in this context. One of them is the truth of reality that the Buddha saw at his enlightenment. And the other way that the Dharma is used is the Dharma as the way that he makes known to others so that they can see the truth of reality for themselves. So in a way what you've got is the Dharma is an experience of the way things are, vision of the way things are, and then the Buddha tries to put it to people in a way that they can make use of it so that they can see the vision for themselves. So what that means is that the Dharma is method in this context, is a method to see reality for yourself. And the Dharma, the Buddha put the Dharma in many different ways for different people so that you could find the method that suits you best. So he used many ways of explaining the Dharma to appeal to the intellect or to the heart or to the imagination. Or even to the guts, even to your kind of life force itself. So he used concepts and abstract ideas. So we're all probably familiar with the term shunyata. Shunyata is an idea and a concept of Buddhism that you have to reflect on. He used the concept of pratichasamutpada, or conditioned co-production. Or he used myths and parables, or metaphors, or images and symbols and similes. You know, some of them, you know, don't quite translate 2,500 years later. Like there's the one of metta being like a catskin bag, which never quite worked for me. But, you know, then there was another one that he used, which was your metta has got to be like the earth, deep, immovable, unshakable. And that worked for me. And he used, he taught people the way things are with his own actions. You know, there were some people who were completely overwhelmed by just the way that the Buddha walked. People like Bahya of the bark garment. When he saw the Buddha, he was just overwhelmed with beauty. Here was the Buddha, so self-possessed, so mindful, that it was a teaching in himself, just in itself, just the way he walked. And sometimes even the Buddha taught by silence. So there's a famous story where he just held up a flower and Mahakashyapa got it. So yeah, so the Dharma is a method and it's practical. You use it, you practice, you put it into effect in your life and you can see the results almost immediately. You know, you can see, yes, the mindfulness of breathing, you start off the meditation, your mind's all over the place, you're thinking about 100 things at once. 20 minutes later, okay, you might not be enlightened. Maybe you are, maybe you're not. But you have calmed down. You know, it has had an effect. And that's the thing about the spiritual life and the Dharma. You put it into practice and it's guaranteed. You make the effort and you see the results. It's not speculation, groundless speculation. It's not just a set of ideas or a philosophy. It's something that you put into practice in your life and it works, and you can see it in this lifetime. And of course you do that with others. You practice the Dharma with others. So the last jewel is the Sangha. And the Sangha has quite a range of meanings, a bit like the word Dharma. And it means the community of Buddhists, right from people who've gained enlightenment to all the people who take inspiration from the Buddhist teachings. So it's kind of got a vertical element. It means our teachers, the people we draw inspiration from. It means our friends around us. And it means the people that we're guides to, the people that we help in the spiritual life. And I was thinking about the value of this and just reflecting on the fact that human beings have a constant search for connection and a constant search for the ideal community. And we long, I've always longed for people who understand me, who are capable of talking to me about things that really matter. A longing for people who we can really communicate all our longings and all our loves and everything that's important to us. And I've been thinking about all those people who just live long and lonely lives, empty lives with buried ideals, who they don't talk about them to anyone. Or they can talk a lot, you know, there's a lot of life where we talk a lot, but nothing is said. We talk about kind of football stars or celebrities or Strictly Come Dancing or The Archers or TV or radio programs. We talk a lot and it's about nothing. You know, there's no actual communication. We're just, energy is just coming out of our mouths and just kind of falling around us. And it's good, you know, in a way it's sort of connecting people. But you can get this sense of, I really need to just express something of more value. I need to communicate. I don't want to just talk. I want to communicate. And, you know, we're constantly, human beings are coming up with new ways to create a true community. We try to create a true community with the family, or with political parties, or with clubs. Sport or communes. And a lot of these things end up failing because people don't share the same values or the same principles. You know, I remember it in London and, trying to kind of, there's a community of people living an alternative lifestyle and living in squats and things like that. And actually, you know, you're trying to create something. You're trying to create a true community. You're trying to create a body of people around you. You can really share what's important. And actually what I found when I took part in that community is it didn't really work. Because we didn't really share the same values and the same principles. So in the Sangha, what we're trying to do is share company with those who share, at least to some extent, our values. And you can find when you come to the Sangha that it's a real relief. I remember finding it a real relief when I came across the Sangha when I was 17. And it's almost like no one had ever had an adult conversation with me, ever, until I went into that room. And they talked to me like I actually was a person with a brain who had interests. And I tell you, it was a real revolution. And such a relief. And I realised about myself that I'm at ease in the Sangha in a way that I'm not quite anywhere else. So sometimes, you know, I go home and I have to admit at this point, I don't really have many friends who aren't Buddhist. I'd like to pretend that I do, but I don't. So basically what I've got is my family and a few old friends. And sometimes I can go and see them and it can be really, really pleasurable. And I can have a really great time. And it's really great because they're all kind of middle class and southern. That just makes you feel so at home. So you can go in with all these middle class southerners. And it's just great because you're just with the people that you grew up with and I can have a real laugh. And it's great fun taking the mickey out of my dad. It just really is. And my brother, really funny. And both my brothers are really handsome. And, they've got lovely kids. And you can have this really, really great time. It's really fun. But there's something missing for me, even in the midst of that kind of pleasure. There's something missing for me, and that's a kind of deep contentment that I only ever experience in the Sangha. And I even experience it when I'm at a kind of weekend retreat that I find really boring. You know, sometimes you do go on weekend retreats and they're really boring. You know, and I think, God, what is this order member whittering on about? You know, I could do much better. I'm ashamed to say. It's not often, but sometimes. But even in the midst of that, and you know, it's uncomfortable, and you haven't slept, and or you, something like you're in Duke's barn and it's overheated and whatever. And even in those times, even when it's a bit tricky and you're thinking, oh, I can't speak to anyone, I feel something that's more important to me than anything else. And that's a kind of connection. There's a kind of communication that I can have with the Sangha members that I can't have with anyone else. And what happens is, even in those situations, I'm seen in a way that I can never be seen with by people who don't even have an inkling of what I truly value. Because the other thing that happens when I go to my family is, generally I'm seen as a bit of a weirdo who doesn't have very much money and leads an incredibly boring life. And then I always go down and I'm always wearing the clothes that they've given me for Christmas, or, you know, so it's like, and then some ways I'm not seen, and there's something about me which we're not really communicating, you know, unless you can, you know, sometimes get it when you have a conversation one to one. My parents are very, you know, they're very interested in my life, and sometimes when I'm one to one with them, I can get some real communication, but it takes certain conditions, and they don't happen very often. So Sangharaksha calls the Sangha, he describes the Sangha as a vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common ideal and a common principle. And he says that in the Sangha, people explore together a spiritual dimension which neither of them could have explored on their own. And I think what he's saying is this, with this vital mutual responsiveness, is that that there's not only a kind of sharing of values in the Sangha, but also there's a potential for real communication. There's a responsiveness there. You're two human beings who can sort of see each other and can respond to each other on the basis of who you really are. And there's a potential there. There's a potential not only of real communication based on the same shared ideals, but there's a potential there of being lifted and inspired and taken up to another dimension. And sometimes that happens too. It's not that you're always bored and Duke's barn is really hot and you want to get out there. Sometimes there's a vital mutual responsiveness that leads you up to another dimension which neither of you could have explored on your own. And that is wonderful. It's just wonderful. It's the best moments of existence. And it can happen even in silence. You know, sometimes they say there's an order convention and there's 600 people sitting in silence meditating. And the energy is palpable and it's wonderful and you don't get it anywhere else. Anyway. So, the three jewels, what's of a true value, timeless value in existence. The Buddha, who's an answer to the question of what you do with your human life. And the Dharma, which is real advice on how to do it. And the Sangha is who we can do it with. And let us not forget the three jewels. Let us not hide them in the freezer or in the coal scuttle or in a locked cupboard under the stairs. Let us adorn the three jewels. Let us polish them. Let us treasure them. Let us take them out and shine them and show them to each other. And let us place them firmly in the centre of our lives. And let us go for refuge to them.